Our podcast today is produced at St. John's Lutheran Church in Salisbury, North Carolina, where we see the church as an important venue for conversations that matter, a place where we can and should engage in good, faithful, and sometimes hard conversations about issues and events that need our attention. For more conversations like these, please visit our website, stjohns-salisbury.org, or follow this podcast on your preferred platform. And by the way, for the record, you, not I, described yourself as a rebel.
That's fine. I'm sure there's been some other descriptions.
I'm pleased to have with me two of the most enjoyable people around, Debbie Martin Perper and her daughter, Pastor Adrienne Martin, here to discuss the 50th anniversary of ordaining women in the Lutheran Church. Debbie is a member of St. John's. She's a certified lay preacher for the North Carolina Synod. She was the wife of a Lutheran minister for 40 years until his death in 2014. Adrienne, likewise, was a member of St. John's for a few years until her call into ordained minister led her to Chicago. She's now the pastor of Sardis Lutheran Church in Hickory. If you don't already know, you will soon discover that these women have some of the strongest gifts for ministry that I have ever seen. Debbie and Adrienne, welcome. We're glad you're here.
Thank you so much, Pastor Rhodes.
50 years ago this November, Elizabeth Platts was ordained as the first female pastor in an American Lutheran church. It was a monumental moment, no doubt. Although she certainly wasn't the first woman in the church's history to serve in a leadership role. You know it as well as I that the Bible lifts up Phoebe in the book of Romans, Paul's partner, Prisca, what the book of Acts calls Philip's prophetic daughters. In early church writings, it's clear that gatherings of Holy Communion were held in the homes of prominent women who served at the table in a sacramental role. The church was pushing against a cultural norm in Rome. The Roman culture said that women and slaves were to be subjugated, and the church was trying to present an entirely different model, an entirely different ethic. And they did so for the first 500 years of the church's existence, allowing women to serve in significant leadership roles, including the sacramental role of serving at the table, only to cave in 500 years later when the Pope forbid women to serve in that capacity. Just recently, Pope Francis declared that he believes the church's ban against female priests is forever. If you could stand in front of Pope Francis, but also any of the leaders of the churches around the world, which represent 70% of the world's Christians who as of yet do not ordain women, what would you say to them? Why ordain women?
Well, that's a good question. I would start by saying, wow, you're missing out. That when I was in divinity school, I was in an ecumenical group, a cohort of disciples of Christ, and we had a humanist and Methodist, and then also Catholic. There was a Catholic woman, and she was so dedicated, so sharp, so faithful, so innovative, and it was a real sadness for the entire cohort that we knew she would never be ordained, and she knew that she'd never be ordained. She has such a giftedness, and to see, you know, to hear it in concept that women are banned from being ordained in the Catholic Church or any church that's not ordaining women, conceptually, you know, in principle, it offends our sense of what's right, but to see it in practice and to see what richness the church misses out on, is a real shame. And I would ask, might he return to scripture to look at those examples you mentioned, and then to see the women who have dedicated their lives in so many different orders to further the life of the church, and to look at them and to hear their voices.
Well, I think that was very nice and positive. My approach, being older, would be, I'm wondering, you know, where that's coming from in him. I wonder, what is it about women that is so uncomfortable? Does he not realize that each of us brings a gift that is a God-given gift And I don't think that he or anyone else has the right to decide which of God's gifts are presented and used. So my question to him would be, why not?
Good. Thank you. Let's pursue that a little bit for both of you, but especially Debbie, because you speak about gifts that women, well, all people bring. I mean, men and women, whoever you are, everyone brings very unique gifts. But in this case, women. What would you say are the most important gifts or attributes or contributions that women pastors bring today?
I think that women, because women have had to fight to show their passion for the ministry, I think that ordained women come with a boldness that come out of that fight. I think that women can view things from a different perspective. I think we process things differently at times. I think we understand things differently. I had read one time that when a country was going through a hard time, that it was never really beaten until the women gave up. And I think that shows the strength that we have. And I don't think that we let necessarily ordinary obstacles get in our way. And I'm not saying that men do, but I think that women are so committed to whatever their passion is. And I think when women have a passion for ordained ministry, they do give it 150%. And that's a lot to bring to the table.
Good. Adrian, what about you? What do you think? And I know this question risks begging you to speak in terms of stereotypes. And I'm not trying to go there at all. I mean, that's not always helpful, although sometimes it can be. I mean, but what do you think? What are some of the distinct or unique or most important contributions, gifts that women bring to ordained ministry?
Well, I appreciate your acknowledging that, because I was thinking about this question and thinking, I don't know if I can make a generalization, because I do think that, you know, people are gifted in such diverse ways, and we share so many gifts together. I do think maybe perhaps having a woman, a pastor who's a woman, may expand someone's notions, a notion of God's presence and God's grace, that just by the mere fact of being embodied by someone else, maybe a person that hasn't been seen in that role very much, that kind of just expands our idea of who God is. Not that we'll ever fully understand, we can't, but maybe that liberation in and of itself is something. And that the good news isn't controlled by any gender, that's the power of God working through whoever God calls. I do think there probably may be patterns of giftedness based on the roles that women play, you know, roles of mothering and taking care, nurturing, perhaps receptivity sometimes. But yeah, I do have a hard time making generalizations like that, just because I have thought about that a lot, because being in sociology, I was in women's studies for a little bit, and sometimes you can just get lost down that rabbit hole. I did, I certainly have thought that way, you know, and there probably are gifts and patterns, but at this point in my journey, I'm not quite able to point to those.
I think that's a very helpful contribution, by saying the presence of a woman leader, especially in a congregational setting, standing in front, preaching, proclaiming, serving at the table, gives the congregation an expanded image, vision of God. I that's powerful. I mean, it really is a strong way of saying. When we sang last week the song Mothering God, well, that's intentionally chosen because we need to expand our understanding of God in that kind of way, a mothering, a feminine, whatever you want to claim it, a presence. And your presence as a woman pastor allows us to expand our vision of who God is. I'm not the one supposed to be talking, but I want to lift that up because that's beautifully said. Adrian, when did you first begin considering a call to ministry? Was there a moment or a time or a person that really sort of led you in that direction?
Yes, there was. I remember being in high school, and I offered to preach for Youth Sunday. And I remember, growing up in the church, seeing Dad preach every week, and, you know, it was a whole family effort. You know, we were always there. I was always acolyte, always crucifer. But I remember it was Youth Sunday, and it was the night before I was supposed to preach. I don't remember if it was the first or second time, because I did it both years. But I was sitting at the computer, and I was house-sitting for someone, but I was just sitting there, and I was trying to write this sermon, and I just had this thought come to my mind, and I thought, is this what Dad does all the time? This is terrible. And then, you know, so that was the first time I thought about, what if I did this too? What would it be like? And that was my first even thought of ever doing something, you know, like pastoring. And then it was my sophomore year in college when it came back around, and I thought, I had been in physics for 2 years at State, and I liked conceptual physics, and I liked thinking about stars and nebula and cosmology, but unfortunately I was terrible at math, so it was a tough major for me, and I realized that I needed to change, and part of it was that it just wasn't meaningful to me. And my question was, what's the most meaningful thing I can do? And pastoring and proclaiming the good news of Jesus Christ and word and sacrament, that, you know, not in that language at the time, but came to my heart. And I really started talking to Dad about it and started getting more serious about it. So I was 20 then.
Let me just, I guess you would say, share a confession. Adrian did mention her interest, her strong interest in seminary and ministry. And it came at a time when we were at the end of David's, or close to the end of David's active ministry. And to be very honest, we were both very, very tired. And we were both very stressed. And when Adrian asked me what I thought of it, I really feel badly saying this. But I said, sweetheart, it is tough. And you're going to have to be tough. And I don't want them to destroy you. And I think, unfortunately, I think that did cause her to step back. It's not something I feel very good about, but it was true, and this was my daughter. And I was going to be what I call, you know, brutally honest. And she did step back. She did step back, and she was so academically inclined that she got one degree after another, and that was great. That was fine. But no matter what path Adrian went down, even though it was successful from her perspective, somehow it always seems that God put her back on the path to seminary. And it happened twice. And it took a while. It took a while for me to finally be able to say, it is tough. It's a tough profession. It's a sacrifice. It's a life. But it's not mine to call. And as she looked at a different possible career, I knew that I had stood in the way, and I figured it was in my best interest to get out of God's way. And so, being a mama, I said, sweetheart, I think it's time we both realize that no matter where you go, God picks you up and drops you back right on the straight path to ordained ministry. And I don't think you have a choice. So that is my confession to you and to God, that I was in the way and he took care of that.
Can I ask a follow-up question, Debbie? And it's really also to Adrian. Adrian, what age were you when you finally stepped foot on a seminary campus as a seminarian?
I was 27.
So 7 years between 20 and 27. Was there anything in that time period that prepared you to be a better pastor?
Yeah, that's a good question. And actually, I need to correct myself. I think I was, in terms of a seminary, I was 31, 32 maybe. Okay. I was 27 when I started my MDiv, but I wasn't in candidacy. And I was in my Lutheran year in candidacy when I was, 30, 31. Yes, there were things that happened. I went into community development. I did AmeriCorps, and those were great, just job, just training for being in a job, learning about communities and learning about sustainability and green energy and things like that. In politics and government. And I also that year, the year I did AmeriCorps, which that was closer to the time that I was going to go to Chicago for my MDiv. I was attending this church in Bourbonnais, which is in Illinois. It's about 60 miles south of Chicago. And I really liked the pastor there. And that whole year of AmeriCorps, I had 1 year where I did this AmeriCorps internship type thing. And they had offered me a job and I had the opportunity to stay there. But you don't know that going into it. And so I had applied to all these PhD programs. That's basically what I did for the first 5 years of my 20s. I applied to PhD programs all the time. That's like all I did. But I got rejected by all of these programs, except all the PhD programs, except for the University of Chicago Master of Arts program. And I remember I got in all these rejection letters and I met with my pastor, Pastor Tom. And I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I have gotten rejected by all of these PhD programs. I haven't heard from Chicago, but I'm probably going to be rejected by them too. And this is a great job, but it's just not what I want. I'd worked with him over doing some green energy projects that year. I'd gone to Illinois Synod Assembly and everything. And I remember he looked at me and then his expression changed and it looked like a light bulb had come on for him. And he said, why don't you become a pastor? I think you would be a really great pastor. And that was the moment I was able to accept my call, because he didn't know my dad. He didn't know I'd ever even thought about seminary. He didn't know anything. I had never told him about my call or my interest. And the fact that he didn't know that, and that he offered that up to me, is when I said, okay. And then the next day at noon, I got my acceptance into the University of Chicago Divinity School. And I talked to the dean and she switched me into the MDiv program after she said she heard I had a love and concern for the church. So that was big. And that's what really set me back on the path.
That's great. So Debbie, you just gave her room and time and space to be even better trained to be the pastor that she is today. Is that okay?
It is okay with me.
That's right. She needed those years.
She needed those years. And it helps me to know that I felt like her call was that strong for her to go off the path a couple of times to another direction. And then, so to speak, I always told her it was like God took a cherry picker and picked her up and put her back on the path, and he dropped her. And she was to go down the path. If she got off the path, he picked her up. It helps me because I really feel that pastors, male or female, give their life for the kingdom of God. And when they put God first, then someone has to be second. And most of the time, that's the family. And so I needed to know that he wanted her that badly so that I can be willing to be second.
Wow. I'm going to ask Adrian to speak. I'm sort of asking the same question, but I want to ask it more broadly about things that may have kept you away from pursuing your call. Your mom has said she kept you away from it, but I want you to think more broadly about that answer, because you grew up as a pastor's kid. Being a pastor's kid, and I can speak from experience, is not easy. I loved it, personally. I mean, I liked sort of being a crucifer and acolyte all the time and being around the church. I mean, that was maybe a little geeky and nerdy, but I enjoyed that part of my growing up. You do learn the ins and outs of the church, but you also learn the good and the bad about the church. You see the church in intimate ways, ways that most kids and most people don't get to see it. So with all of that experience, was there anything that almost kept you away? You know, as a pastor's kid, you're always in the back of your mind. You've always got women and men on the back pew, old folks who are asking you not, are you going to be a pastor, but when are you going to be a pastor, right? Was there anything that almost kept you away from pursuing a call?
Yes, there were. I think one of the things that kept me away, it would be how I saw how it consumed him and his time. That ministry I saw is all consuming. And I saw him work so hard. And also when I was in high school, he got cancer. And in my mind, in my high school mind, I associated it together. And so I've had to really try to untangle that yes, you know, you do have to make sure that you take time for Sabbath and take care of yourself. And there are other healthful habits that you need to be doing at the same time. And it kept me, there was something attractive about it being all consuming, and there was something unattractive about it being unconsuming, all consuming. And that's something I still work on in terms of having doing my best to see other parts of my life and to have a wholeness there. My dad, ministry was everything. So I saw that. And then my grandfather, he loved the spotlight, loved to preach, and he was great at it. And I don't like the spotlight, and I don't like things to be all consuming. And then my great grandfather, parishioners paid them in chickens and eggs and vegetables, and there were no pensions at that time. So his brothers and sisters had to build, he and his wife, their house. And so they weren't able to accumulate wealth or be prepared in that way. And so looking at that, there's really not much that would be very attractive about it. in terms of there's no real draw. Seeing how hard it is. And then, what are the, we all, I think, kind of look for some benefits to it. And there are many wonderful things that do come out of it. But something that I think was neat was that even though growing up I saw my dad working so hard, and we often didn't understand why he was leaving to do this or going off to do this, when I've come into the role, I realize that directly he had such a relationship with his parishioners that it wasn't like how we saw it from the outside of the relationship. Like parishioners, I think, love the pastor's family, and you love them too. But between the pastor and wanting to provide the care at that moment that a pastor provides, I realized why my dad did that so much. And that was a realization I didn't really expect. But I've really come to realize how profound that relationship is. And that to your family, they may have been like, why are you leaving again? But you're like, oh my goodness, I need to get to my person who needs me right now. And so that's been an important realization for me.
I get that. I really do. I mean, thank you for sharing it, because I could almost feel, I've never processed it in that way, but I could almost process different context, different story, different dads, different pastors, but essentially say the exact same thing. So yeah, thank you. Debbie, I'm going to pick on you for a second. You were a pastor's wife for 40 years during a time, as we've mentioned earlier, that pastors were effectively associate pastors. I mean, you were involved in lots of different things in the church's life, the daily operations of the church. In that regard, And you know what I mean by this. You are part of that very long line of women who ran the church. I mean, some of the church's best leaders in our history, talking about 2,000-year history, have been women who were never ordained. To be an outstanding woman leader in the church, you don't have to be ordained, although we thankfully now can ordain, and we see some remarkably gifted women pastors. But you understand more than anyone this transition from a church that was run by women to a church that is now led by women, including your daughter. What is the biggest difference?
Well, my generation had made some progress from, say, my mother-in-law's generation. And she was the perfect example of what you just described. My generation had some rebellion in it. Women, quite a few of the pastor's wives had careers. And there was really some tension between the church and the pastor Stanley in saying, you called me, you did not call her. And I remember in the interview of our last church, they had interviewed David Nicely, they had grilled David Nicely, and then they turned to me and they said, what is your role, Mrs. Martin? And by that point, I'm trying to think how old I was, but I was old enough, I was done with being intimidated. And I said, I know. I said, my role is to support Pastor Martin so he can take care of you. And even that first Sunday that we were introduced, you know how there's always that one older matriarch? She came to me and she said, Pastor Martin sent me to talk to you. I tried to tell him what I wanted you to do, and he told me to come see you. And I said, okay. She said, I want you for the next four Sundays to stand beside him when people are leaving the church so they know who you are. And I said, no, that's not my way. I guess she thought I couldn't hear because she told me again. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I will find my way into the church. And she looked at me. I remember it. She was not happy. And fortunately, I didn't care. That worked out well. But she wanted me to be the role of my mother-in-law's generation. And I was trying to say, it's a new time. I come with new skills, and I come on my own terms. Now, I didn't know enough not to go too boldly, because then I would come in conflict with David. But I knew where those boundary lines were. And I enjoyed being a leader in the youth group. I didn't really care for LCW. I'm sorry, but that just wasn't my thing. But I went. I did go. I just didn't like it. But I think what I saw is that women, when we really find a cause, whatever it is in the church, it's a strong force. And to be honest, I don't think too many husbands are going to fight about it. I mean, I think that when women lead, they lead with, and maybe the word's not passion, but they persistence. Is it persistence is a good word? But that was a change to me, because we did transition from being the church secretary and doing the bulletins to being more of a leadership and not just supporting the men in what they thought was important, but in our own decisions of what we thought needed to be supported and pushed to the front of the agenda.
Yeah, that's very helpful, actually. And by the way, for the record, you, not I, described yourself as a rebel.
That's fine. I'm sure there's been some other descriptions.
Right on. That your I don't know if you call it your generation, but your what were you? Group of women, whatever, who helped transition towards an active women's ministry or women's ordained ministry. In that era, sort of the 60s, early 70s, whatever, where, and we know sociologically, we know what was going on in America, women becoming more independent, women entering the workforce in much more significant ways, women becoming leaders of organizations, institutions. I mean, it started slowly, of course, but that's what was happening. Likewise in the church. I mean, in some ways, what you all were pushing and sort of preparing the church for was a woman who was going to serve you as a leader. Is that what you're saying? I think that's actually a very keen observation, and I'm not sure that we've ever said thanks to your crew of women who did just that, but it's true. I mean, you were really preparing the way.
Well, the way I summed up all of our years together in ministry was that the people in the congregation and the people in the community, they truly loved David. They loved him. Me, they respected. I'm not so sure they loved me, but they respected.
Well, no. I wasn't in your church in those days, but people love you now, Debbie, so we'll just leave it at that. Hey, let me ask a final question. You all, we could talk forever, but I want to go back to Elizabeth Platts. She's recognized as the first woman, at least in American Lutheranism. Of course, around the world, Lutheran churches had already ordained women, but in American Lutheranism. If she was sitting here with us today, if she was standing before you, you were able to have a conversation with her today, what is one thing that you would say to Elizabeth Platts?
I would thank her for paving the way.
I would ask her, what changed that made God's nudge become God's call?
Well, I began by saying that you all are some of the most interesting and dynamic and faithful and passionate leaders in the church, and I am still thinking that. So thank you for what you mean to the church at large. And Adrian, thank you for being such a good pastor at Sardis. They love you to death there. And Debbie, for being such a fun and important preacher to congregations, you know, now in your role in lay preaching. And anyway, thank you all for who you are. And thank you for joining us today. And maybe we'll have a chance to do this again sometime.
Sounds wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
Bye.
And thank you for joining us for another episode of Conversations That Matter, where we engage in conversation with thoughtful, passionate leaders who are making a difference in our community and in our lives. Until next time.